Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. With Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course, we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, Nicola Sturgeon's husband, Peter Murrell, the former Scottish National Party chief executive, has been charged in connection with the embezzlement of funds from the SNP. Westminster is rocked by yet another scandal as Conservative MP Mark Menzies resigns the whip over alleged misuse of campaign funds. Plus, Britain's medicine shortages. New research suggests the crisis has got significantly worse since Brexit, with a lack of antibiotics now considered the new normal. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, only on Talk TV. It's the final show of the week and we've pulled out all the stops. We delve further into the migrant crisis as it's revealed a failed asylum seeker whose deportation was blocked by a do-gooder has pleaded guilty to raping a 15-year-old girl. How the hell have the government let this happen? Someone who has finally left the country of his own accord is Prince Harry. The Duke has officially listed the US as his primary residence. God bless America. Or should I say God help America? And would you pay over £250 for a coffee? Because that's what one coffee shop in London is actually charging. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Buckle up, let's get the show on the road. Now, the husband of former Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, the former chief executive of the SNP, has been charged in connection with the embezzlement of party funds, having been taken into custody and questioned by police this very morning. You may remember he was arrested last April before being released that time without being charged and had resigned as the party's chief executive the month before. The ongoing probe into the SNP's finances is investigating the fate of £600,000 worth of donations made to the party. We'll be keeping an eye on this over the coming days. But joining me tonight, first of all, journalist and broadcaster Sam Dowler, Conservative commentator Samantha Smith, and barrister and broadcaster Andrew Ebel. I think that's the first time we've got it right, you know. It was actually really good.
I loved that.
Like we planned it.
Very smart.
Yes. Yes. Samantha, welcome to the Independent Republic for the first time.
Thank you.
Sam, welcome back.
Thank you.
You I saw last night.
What a party that was.
So I apologise for not being here last night, but I was at James Wells' MBE party, which was brilliant.
Glorious.
Looked like a hoot, I have to say.
Took me until about now to recover from it. Anyway, here we go. Let's talk about this ridiculous situation, right? Because it's only a week on from the latest round of Tory sleaze with old William Ragg and Willie Gates. He was caught in a sexting honey trap. The backbenchers of the government are now going full steam ahead. Have a look at this. Mark Menzies, MP for Fylde, has had the whip suspended over claims that he misused campaign funds that ended up in his personal bank account. He claimed to an elderly campaign aide that he was locked up by bad people. He also claimed he had 14,000 of campaign donation money transferred to his account for medical expenses, all after reportedly having sex with an escort and being quizzed by police on the bizarre suspicion of him attempting to, wait for it, get a dog drunk. Now, that may sound like a long list, but there's another list of former Tories who have lost the whip over some scandal or other. Here goes. Now, check this out. You might have forgotten some. Imran Ahmed for sexually abusing a teenager. Peter Bone for exposing his genitals. Chris Pincher for drunken groping. Matt Hancock, remember him, signing up for I'm a Celebrity. Charlie Elphick, jail for sexual assault. Andrew Bridgen, for comparing the COVID vaccine rollout to the Holocaust. Neil Parrish, accused of watching porn in the Commons. Julian Knight, allegations of a serious sexual assault. Bob Stewart, racially aggravated public order offence. Rob Roberts, sexual harassment. David Warburton, three allegations of sexual harassment. Lee Anderson, alleged Islamophobia. but he's now defected to Reform. And Crispin Blunt, arrested on suspicion of rape and possession of controlled substances. I mean, it's not really like a political party at all. It's like some
House
kind of mad... I mean, it's some kind of mad organisation.
Well, scandal bingo, isn't
right.
it?
I woke up this morning and Grindr was... trending on Twitter for...
I didn't know what you were going to say there.
Well, for those who don't know, it's a salubrious gay dating app.
Had they had the whip removed from Grindr?
There was this...
No, so you can still get it.
Grindr would close down if they tried to remove the whips. No. And it's just more embarrassment for the Tories, more embarrassment for gay Tories, for LGBT people anyway. And it's like... To call up an old, like, an elderly person who helps you with your local
at 3 o'clock in the morning
at 3:15 it's saying you've been trapped, and he's obviously gone round for some sort of, I mean, it's allegedly gone round.
He denies all of it, right?
Of course he does.
But then he's getting
blackmailed, and here we are again. It's just mortifying.
And it's the classic cyber scam, isn't it? You're working on that sort of basis. I'm locked. I haven't got my phone, Mum.
Right.
It's somebody else, and I've borrowed a phone. Please send this money.
This is just off the back of the explosive BBC Panorama investigation, which exposed that many young staffers and parliamentary aides and those working within the saucy halls of Westminster feel unsafe or unable to complete their work, because those in positions of power are so completely devoid of moral compass and so protected by the old guard. You know, you see this with Crispin Blunt, you see this with, on the other end of the spectrum, Keith Vaz.
Yeah.
And his many, many, many scandals.
Right.
It seems as though those in positions of power, the only point at which they will take action, the whips or the party or whoever it is, the powers that be, is when their reputation is brought into question and when it becomes public.
Yeah.
If it's left up to those within the old guard to take a stand, they never will.
No.
Because it's easier just to ignore it because, you know, this is a very important man or a very important person making very important decisions, and who cares if they go
Where
up and screw it in turn?
Also, do you think it's different down there? Because in society now, if somebody makes an allegation, the tendency is for people to believe it before they do anything else. But I wonder if in Westminster the tendency is to not believe it and to go, actually, because they have had a few of those as well where people have been accused of things which it turned out they didn't do. But I wonder if they've got sort of a different operational kind of method of being, just because they seem to not believe the story.
I think you're so right, Mike. And the other question is why it took so long for them to deal with it.
Right.
Because apparently they've known about it for a long time.
Right.
The same way as they talked about other scandals is you've got to get out. You've got to have a procedure in place.
Yeah.
As soon as you get this, you investigate and make sure that appropriate action is taken.
Surely it's a red flag once you've got the dog drunk, right?
Do you know what his defence for that apparently is? That the dog actually got himself drunk. He's going, you're going, sorry?
The dog just kind of got hold of the booze by himself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, having worked in Westminster in Parliament, I worked there from the age of 17 until I went off to university at nearly age 20.
And what university?
Durham, exactly.
And so how did you find it? Did you find yourself kind of having to be careful
I think it was very,
around people?
It was very much, it was like stepping into a pre-Weinstein world.
Yeah.
When, you know, I was very fortunate that my MP, she was a woman. She had been in you know, politics for many years, and she sort of enveloped me and protected me in many ways. But I saw, just walking the halls every day, there was this sort of leering attitude, and this attitude that especially women and especially young men, young gay men, when it comes to some of the scandals that you know, Mark Menzies is included in, people should feel privileged that these very important men are paying attention to them. And so when allegations come out, the first question that's asked isn't, well, how can we protect the victim or the alleged victim? It's, well, were you doing something to bring it on?
I have to say it's true. As a not so young gay man now, but like there were times I've worked in media for a couple of decades, and there were times, and I have to say this, it is a gay thing, as you say, young gay men. Like if an older man, whether they're gay or not, you know, is handsy or whatever, you just go, all right, mate, or like you push it away it's almost like it's okay to grab my bum, but it's not okay to grab a woman's bum anymore. Yeah. But
it's so important to call it out.
Of course.
But that's the other thing that's weird, because a lot of people in Westminster must know that your experience is exactly what happens to a lot of young people. And I've heard that story from many people who have gone into it and thought it was going to be the dream job and suddenly found themselves either, you know, victimised in some bad, horrible way. No. But the thing I find astonishing is that, you know, I've got a lot of gay friends. You know, most of my gay friends are either in a relationship or they've got a partner or, you know, they might have the odd boyfriend. But they don't sort of get taken hostage in the middle of the night. They don't kind of go on Grindr and sell information to people they don't know.
Well, that's the thing. You'll get your hang... Especially something like Grindr, for example, is... And this is the thing with men. Men often don't know when to stop, when the stop button is, and like, and if they're using it late at night, etc., they will take risks. Mm. Especially if you are not out, for example, or if you're married, they would take more of a risk because it's like, oh, and it's like, I don't know whether the danger is a thrill, etc., but it is the risky factor. Yeah. So he's got himself into a scenario, and obviously, like. Where is his mind? Where he's an MP. You can't do this.
This is the issue with many of those in the Westminster bubble. When we talk about the Westminster bubble when it comes to policy or politics or decisions being made that aren't real life knowledge. Exactly. But that's very true when it comes to relationships and sexual misconduct within Westminster as well. It exists in this sort of ecosystem that is devoid of any understanding of how real world relationships would work. Because in the real world, a 50-something year old man preying on a 21-year-old intern, or you know, going on dating sites and giving out their colleagues' work information, would be it would be a fireable offence. It just wouldn't happen.
Appalling, isn't it? And what's going to happen is people should learn the lessons. And I predicted earlier on, with the lead up to the election, there's going to be more and more of these scandals going to come to light across all parties.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. And the reality is,
but it's a very high proportion of any workplace. I mean, you know, people worked in lots of different places, and there's always one or two strange people. But I mean, there's an awful lot of them in Westminster. It seems to me. And I wonder, you know, I know they've supposedly sort of clamped down a bit on drinking culture and, you know, not as many bars as they used to be, and they're not open, I don't think, as late as they used to be. But it's still a place of work that's got pubs in it.
Yes.
You know, at the end of the day. So that's going to be trouble, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I think blaming it on the booze is
well, I'm not blaming it on the booze, but I'm saying if you've got sociable...
No, I agree, because it filled the whole thing.
You know,
feels
if
like
we had a pub here and at the end of this show we all went down the end of the corridor... And stood around with a load of, you know, 55 other people.
Yeah. That isn't going to make
stuff would happen that wouldn't otherwise happen when you go home.
But it isn't going to make people who are under normal circumstances.
It might,
be,
though.
Would it make them be creepy?
It might.
I think the issue is more so the lack of accountability from those higher up, from the whips, from those in positions of power. You know, whether it's the executive of the National Labour Committee or whether it's the Tory whips who aren't. Holding this behaviour to account, and in many circumstances, the attitude is as long as you don't do it within your own office, then it's okay. As long as it's someone outside, then you know it's the whole idea of don't poo on your own doorstep.
Is there also an element of the whips having this information on people and holding it over them and going, I'll tell you what, we're going to use this when we want to use it.
Do you remember the old Tory whips list?
We're not going to shop you, but when we want you to vote for something, we're going to come to you.
You're so right, Mike, and we hear about this, about the whips. They will use this information. And appropriate to keep people in line.
Isn't that just corruption?
Well, I think what we need to do, and it's a really serious issue, what we need to do is to call it out in the right sort of way that you do, because it should stop. It is appalling, and whilst we can joke about the other bits and pieces, you're absolutely right. Mm. It's horrendous. And we're going to get more and more of it. I say more and more of it. It's going to work on that sort of basis, especially in the lead-up to the election.
I mean, it's interesting to see whether it's these kinds of people that are naturally attracted to politics or whether it's something about Westminster culture and politics that corrupts otherwise ordinary or upstanding people to commit these very heinous, horrible crimes.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Are people who are likely to do that attracted to this kind of job?
Yes.
Or do they become that way because they see that they can do it?
But then also at the bottom... The bottom line is that the British people are sick of sleaze. They're sick of this kind of story. They don't even because obviously these people come from constituents. So so one of the constituents that was looking at porn in Westminster.
Neil Parish.
It's from near where my family are and it's like you know if you're going door to door, it's like it's just gross.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, and people don't want that. It's over.
And also the fact is, I mean, Willie Ragg, for example, has said, "Oh well, the thing is, I'm not going to resign my job because I'm leaving at the next election. Well, hang on a minute, matey. You know, we're paying your salary from now
until whenever that is. It very much reminds me of Claudia Webb in that respect. Yeah. You know, hanging on to the salary for everything they can when the public don't want them, when they've disgraced themselves, their party, their reputation, they can't make any meaningful change for their constituents.
Yeah.
It's a selfish attitude that those in power seem to want to self-preserve and hold on to the grips of power as much as they can.
And I looked at Mr. Menzies' expenses, and he's claiming, as amongst many other MPs, it's not very particularly different, but he's got a flat in London that he's paying 1,800 quid a month for, which we're paying the rent on.
Yeah.
No, you know, in my view, you know, that's an even bigger reason to change the system than just their salary. He's only getting like nearly 90 grand a year, but he's also getting the equivalent of sort of, you know, another 25,000 to rent a flat.
And a free bachelor pad where he can get tied up as much as he wants.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, why bother to go out at all? You know, just, you know, tie yourself down. I mean, God knows, but I mean, it's an incredible story. I couldn't believe it. Even for them. This one is pretty bizarre. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Thank you, everyone. We'll have you back shortly. A failed asylum seeker whose deportation was blocked by a do-gooder cabin crew has pleaded guilty to rape. More coming up on that after the break. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, a 40-year-old failed asylum seeker, Aniset Mayel, who once protested against outside a detention centre, holding a sign that read, "Migrants are not criminals," could now face life in jail for raping a 15-year-old. Mayel was able to stay in Britain after a failed asylum bid as his deportation was blocked by a do-gooder cabin crew who prevented his repatriation flight from taking off. Brilliant. I'm now joined by international border control expert Henry Bolton, and still with me is barrister and broadcaster Andrew Eborn. Welcome back, Andrew and Henry. Nice to see you. You probably remember this case, as do I. And there was a big hoo-ha about it, because I think even the passengers on the plane was telling the cabin crew and everybody else, oh, leave him alone, take him off the plane. You know, this whole, it wasn't just a cabin crew of do-gooders, it was an entire plane load.
It was.
Meanwhile, this guy, who it turns out is actually a criminal, has now been done for being a criminal.
Yeah, funny old thing. It was an Air France plane, so we should get that straight. Because for me, I've been saying for a while that, you know, with regards to the Rwanda plan, which is a red herring, it's not going to deter anything, but it's the government's plan and they want to go ahead with it, and they're having all sorts of problems with it, as we all know. But one of the problems that they've got is that they have so far not identified any airline that is prepared to fly people to Rwanda.
Right.
And therefore, the Ministry of Defence is on standby. This is the same Ministry of Defence that's on standby to deal with things in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, you know, and wherever else. Its priority is not to be flying asylum seekers around the world. But I have been saying for a long time that the government needs to build up the immigration service to such an extent that it's got its own people to escort, because at the moment it's outsourced.
Yeah.
In fact, I think they've just recently issued a contract to a company to provide escorts. So these people are civilians. They have no powers of arrest. Yeah. They have whatever quality of training that they have and so on. And if you are going to put asylum seekers who may well decide to kick off, particularly if there's previous for a flight being cancelled or them being taken off the flight if they do kick off on the flight. If you're going to put such people on a civilian aircraft with cabin crew who have no training in dealing with such a situation, you know, in that sort of context, with passengers who might be frightened and worried about it because they're civilians as well, it's, you know, why catch them up in this? The government needs to put the correct resources behind the plan that it wants to implement. It has failed singularly to do that.
My understanding is, well, there are two issues on this. My understanding is they do have a backup plan if some of the airlines don't take it. But it's the more important issue.
Well, they say they have.
Well, what is it, though? Yeah, well, exactly. We need to. Right. They say they've got other planes which they make something happen. But the most important thing is, which is the main sort of thrust of this story, is this guy is a criminal.
Yeah.
So the question is, and he's admitted to raping this 15-year-old girl. The question is, when did that occur?
Yes. Did it not happen after he was taken off the plane?
I think that's
my
the reality.
My understanding is that he hadn't committed the rape before he was... He was being deported for other reasons.
Yes, it did. But this is also nigh on 20 years ago. And we're still... This case is still... I mean, OK, but he was supposed to have been deported. Then he wasn't deported because of this incident.
Right.
And that whole scenario of this chap being allowed to remain in the UK, despite all of that, has continued until the point that he commits a rape.
And we know from a story that came out, I think, a couple of weeks ago from the Home Office itself, that hardly anybody gets deported, even if they actually are ordered to be deported. Yeah. Mostly they remain in the country. Mostly they disappear. Nobody really knows where they are. We've already lost, I think, this year 6,000 asylum seekers. Nobody knows where they've gone. But equally, the ones who are apparently supposed to be deported, apart from the ones that went to Albania, they just don't leave.
No, you're absolutely right, Mike. And what we need is that clarity. And we need people to actually enforce the rules. If people are criminals, and it's fine now holding this guy holding up a sign saying migrants are not criminals, well, he is a criminal.
Right.
Well, and he's admitted now. We need to work on
the basis. This is the whole thing about people's argument with regards to the ECHR, pulling out of the ECHR, because it removes one of the layers that prevents these deportations taking place.
Yeah.
But time and time again, I go back to the point that Parliament is sovereign.
Yeah.
Parliament can make these laws. The government can make these decisions to make these things happen.
Mm.
It is a matter of courage and political courage and the determination, the will to do it.
Yes.
So what should the law be, then? Singularly, what should the rule be?
Well, the rule...
Yes, in terms of... If you say you can get certainty...
Excuse me, I'm asking the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I
mean, you know, there's some reversal of roles going on. But anyway, it's a good question, so I'll carry on.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, you've got umpteen rules. But, I mean, if a foreign national commits a crime that is imprisonable for 6 months or more, at the moment I think it's 12 months, then I would want to see them deported. But you have to have the operational resources in place. To do that, you have to have the operational resources in place. You have to have the political will to drive through the bureaucracy, the naysayers, the activists.
Right. Yes.
And if the law does not allow you to do it, which actually I believe that it does, then you've got to change the law.
Yeah.
If you are a government, that a party that has the majority in Parliament, you know, you can drive that through.
Absolutely. And the law can say anything. The same way as you can declare a country safe, even if it's not, just by changing the law.
But the Rwanda bill at the moment, we heard the other day that now we've got Costa Rica, Botswana, Ivory Coast, and Armenia being talked to, you know, where there are negotiations going on regarding about sending asylum seekers there as well as Rwanda. Fine, we're passing a Rwanda safety bill.
Yes.
And as I said at the time, that was that's a one-off piece of legislation. It is utterly flawed because it is not part of a comprehensive plan.
Yes.
You work out your comprehensive plan. Does it include Armenia? Does it include all these other countries? You draft the law and put it in front of Parliament accordingly.
Yes. Absolutely.
At the moment,
they don't seem to be very good at this, which is basically their
job. Mike, they're appalling.
Yeah. Right.
There's hundreds
of people at their disposal in the Home Office who could frame this particular law if they wanted to.
It's not that difficult.
But I asked the question, could they? Because I'm honestly not sure, A, that they want to.
Yes.
B, that they do have the knowledge and the experience to do so.
Right.
And the other point
but
as
also,
well,
if they don't have the planes, shouldn't we not have the ability? But I'll remind you of something else that happened. When there was a suggestion we should send them to Ascension Island.
Yes.
And the RAF actually said, we're not going to do that.
Right.
The RAF refused
to do it.
Yes. RAF has got other commitments.
Well, yeah, they have commitments, but it was almost like they didn't want to do it. It wasn't so much that we've got too many commitments. It was as a sort of a matter of policy, they wouldn't do it.
We've got so many of these people, it's worth buying the aircraft and getting the staff to crew them.
Mike's absolutely right, though. You have to have a policy which is going to be enforced. Otherwise, it's just the letter of the law needs to be enforced. And the other point, and Mike made the point brilliantly last week, is that we discovered that during the coronation, these various countries were tapped up over the Volovans, weren't they, to say, well, will you take a few for
us? Would you mind? Yeah, absolutely right. But meanwhile, the Rwanda bill's been delayed again.
Yes.
We were told it might actually become a bill by Friday, and that's not now going to happen because the Lords have put the amendments back in, which the Commons took out.
And they say the first people will be by spring, but they don't say which year.
There are two things I'd like to say. But one is that this failure, as this case actually demonstrates or illustrates, is putting the British public at risk, which is a massive government failure of the first order. The second thing is that the government, there was a referendum, the Brexit referendum, in which...
I've heard of that.
in which most people voted, or a lot of people voted, because they wanted immigration under control. Yeah. And it has exploded since. Not because of Brexit, but because of the poor governance of this by the British government and Parliament. And Then in 2019, there was a very clear majority for the Conservative Party on the back of a promise to reduce immigration.
Yeah.
The British public has spoken democratically as to what their will is. Yeah. Okay. Now, democracy is a protection if you listen to it.
Mm.
If politicians ignore the democratic will as expressed in the ballot,
yeah,
then democracy does not work as an insurance policy, yeah, any longer. And then we see this sort of thing happening. The British public put at risk. You see sort of localised problems that you can't control anymore because you've sort of kind of lost track of where you are democratically. So there are a whole raft of problems here. There is no national strategy. And it goes back to the point, and I think earlier you discussed Mike Menzies, yeah, and
well, I was going to say they're all too busy getting held hostage.
Well, they're getting held hostage
and looking for partners on Grindr.
These people, surely, we the British public should be demanding that we've got people who have experienced enough,
yes,
have the ability, have the strategic, yeah, grasp and everything to be effective legislators, yeah, for the nation and to be leaders.
Yes.
Because at the moment, we don't have any of
that.
Well,
have a look at this story.
And I'm not being party political there.
Yeah. Listen, no, we're talking about the Home Office, effectively. Here we've got a story today. A Home Office caseworker has been arrested on suspicion of trying to sell a UK residency to an asylum seeker living in Northern Ireland. Apparently, this official allegedly contacted a vulnerable man and asked for £2,000 in return for approving his refugee application.
It's a scandal.
I mean, again, whenever you see these kinds of stories, yeah, you think, well, there can't be just one, can
no,
there?
No.
There'll be a load of these kinds of stories.
And you're absolutely right, Mike. So what we need to do is, and again, they need to, as soon as you hear about these things, they say, look, this is the problem, this is how we sorted it,
yeah,
so we make sure it doesn't happen again. These are the extra precautions.
Yeah, but they don't do any of that.
No, they don't. And it's just so clear. That's why we need leaders on that basis.
I'm sorry, I've got to the cynical stage now, and I try to avoid being cynical, but in politics you can't. I wonder who this person is.
Yeah.
Were did they work for an agency that were they in some way connected with
it? It says that they've been suspended,
yeah,
well, people. So, I mean,
well, if we know that they've done it, they should be out in their ear.
Well, exactly right. But, I mean, once again, there'll be an investigation,
yeah,
as to how it all happened.
To be fair, there should be an investigation, and I think the usual employment law things is...
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's got to be fair. So... Abhorrent if it happened. If it has happened, they've got to respond very, very quickly and say, this is what we're going to do about it. And also to root it out. As Mike brilliantly points out, it's not going to be the only case.
Yeah.
No, it's not. And this is something that has been happening, particularly, yes, I'm going to name them, in Romania and Bulgaria for the last 20 years.
Right.
They have been issued, there has been a problem with officials in those countries selling passports and falsifying identification and, yes, travel documents that are biometric.
Yes.
But, of course, if you're going to have people who lack the integrity to police the system properly and are prepared to try and make a quick buck out of it, then you've got a real problem because biometric passports, yep, if the breeder documents are compromised, then the biometric passport, which is taken, yeah, far more as identification than it ever previous passports, then you've got a border problem.
Absolutely.
But that's the thing, the whole
security
system is not fit for purpose.
No.
This
correct.
Particular member of staff has apparently been arrested as well. Who knows what they're going to charge him with, but at the end of the day, you know, we know that none of the Home Office system works, yes, in any way, shape or form. Yeah.
From and I think
people land on the beach at Dover or, yeah, wherever they land.
But Mike,
they are basically here for life.
I've said on many occasions, we need a properly comprehensive and integrated cross-government strategy here, run not by the Home Office, not by the Foreign Office, not by the Cabinet Office, by, if you like, a border czar who has the authority from Cabinet to pull together and mutually support all of the efforts of all of the different agencies involved in this. There's about 18 by my calculation. There should be a set of national objectives about this, and it needs to be driven through. When you have this government department doing that and another one doing this, Foreign Office, the Home Office, the whoever, then they're all working to their own secretaries of state, their own hierarchies, and you end up with...
It's a fudge, isn't it? It just doesn't work.
We're
out of time, so thank you very much to both.
Got me wound up.
You're watching, we'll be talking about it for many years, I'm sure, yes, to come. We're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, Iran says its hands are on the trigger as it warns Israel against retaliation to last weekend's missile attack. Do not go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Iran has warned Israel it is likely to review its nuclear stance if its atomic facilities are threatened as tensions rise following the Islamic Republic's drone and missile attack on Israel this past weekend. Iran's Revolutionary Guard said on Thursday that Tehran may reconsider its nuclear policy, which it has long insisted is purely peaceful, but which Western powers say has put it on the threshold of becoming a weapons state. Joining me now is former Navy SEAL Rob O'Neill. Rob, a very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. This situation has been sort of on the boil for a while, hasn't it? And it's now finally boiled over, as you, I suppose, would say last weekend when Iran fired all of those missiles into Israel. We're hearing that Israel might agree not to sort of hit back in a massive way. But, of course, they would argue, well, we've been dealing with these attacks from various places like Hezbollah and Hamas, Iranian-backed, for years.
Right. Well, thank you for having me, first of all. Yeah, the thing that concerns me initially with this is how this administration in the United States says their support is ironclad, but take the win and don't attack. We're not going to support an attack. That brings up what kind of backdoor deals has Iran been having with the United States and potentially Great Britain in Turkey, places like that. Iran would never attack Israel if they knew that the United States and the UK would help Israel to counterattack. If they knew they wouldn't, they would. So they did. And I mean, it would be the perfect opportunity. Iran knows this too, that if we re-attack, we being the West and Israel attack them, it would show how weak their regime is, how they have no capability of shooting down any of our aircraft, and we could hit their nuclear sites. And there's a number, I mean, they put some weak sanctions on Iran, and they're asking Israel not to re-attack, like some you know, automakers and drone makers, but they're not touching oil sanctions because they China buys it, and, by God, we can't make China mad because China owns pretty much every politician in the world. So there's a lot more going on simply than this, but it's so weak to see the United States especially saying it's ironclad, and then they literally do nothing.
Right. Well, particularly since a lot of people blame the Democrats, going all the way back to Barack Obama, for this Iranian situation being allowed to get quite as far as it did. Biden taking off the and a freezing of the assets, allowing them to get their hands on more money to presumably buy more weapons.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's what they're going to do, and I don't understand for the life of me why Iran, why the Democrats love Iran. I don't know if they honestly believe they're not going to try to build nuclear missiles just because they say they won't.
Right.
I don't know if there will be peace if they, we used to say we don't negotiate with terrorists. They paid $6 billion for 5 terrorists. We went from 400,000 barrels of oil a day to 2 million barrels of oil, again, going to China. And, China and Iran are hand in hand. And there's some, if we're flying pallets of cash into Tehran at night, there's something deep going on. You can't really trust any politician as far as you can throw them, but there's something very odd going on, and it's almost the way that the left spins how Israel's all of a sudden just the bad guy when they're the only democracy in the Middle East.
Well, I don't think there's any other country on the planet that would be advised to take the win, in their words, given that, they've just been under attack, constant attack, and a specifically, very much heavily raised attack over the last weekend. Hundreds and hundreds of missiles coming in. I mean, thank God they've got the Iron Dome and they've got all those, abilities to defend themselves, because we haven't. If they started firing rockets at Britain, we'd be screwed.
Right, and with all the proxies that are going on around the world and all the love for places like Hamas and the Houthis, nothing nowadays would surprise me. It's scary. And just because Israel has a great defense is not a win.
Right.
It means they fired, hundreds of missiles and drones at them. They shot down 99%.
Right.
We're very lucky that Iran is incompetent, and a lot of their, like 50% of their missiles didn't fire. It was a misfire, exploded on launch. It's just sending such a weak message. You got that small country of Israel right there. Everyone around them is attacked. I mean, even, like places like Jordan are stepping up.
Right.
To the plate, because they can basically tell what between right and wrong as far as World War III.
Right.
And they've got missiles flying over their airspace, and that's why they're stopping them. But I think it comes with the weak withdrawal from Afghanistan. The United States itself proved we lack alliance solidarity. A lot of countries don't trust the United States anymore, and with that, a lot of people aren't really sure either. We need a strong Western alliance for deterrence, and we're going away from that right now, and we're going towards autocracy. That we're appeasing different countries that have these regimes, and in Iran especially, the Iranian people are not to blame here. And every time they rise up, our media is silent. And then the Iranians do what they always do. We don't support the right. Now, that's how to beat the Iranian regime, is with a coup, something like that.
Exactly.
You know, I've been to war a bunch of times. I hate war. It's violent. Innocent people always get killed. But, I mean, enough is enough here. And just defending yourself is not a win. At some point, you need to punch back.
Well, exactly right. And also, on the streets of Tehran, even as we speak, women are being dragged off and locked up because they're freeing their hair, because they're taking their scarves off and they're showing their heads and they're getting taken away by the bleeding morality police. But I was hopeful, I have to say, Rob, that when Saudi Arabia came out and when Jordan came out against Iran, I thought that might be the beginning of some kind of, you know, Middle Eastern accord, because nobody likes Iran in that part of the world. But it doesn't seem to have gone anywhere diplomatically, does it?
No, not at all. I mean, this basically is coming down to the Sunni-Shia split.
Yeah.
Because the Iranians are Shia, and then pretty much everyone else are Sunni. And Saudi Arabia certainly does not want Iran to get nuclear weapons, but they're on the way to it. And this is just a good excuse for them to say, well, if they attack us, we're going to go back on our word and build the nukes, when we know damn well they are. Right. No one wants to admit it. They're already enriched to a certain level, but they need a couple more percentages to get the atomic bomb.
Right.
Now, Saudi Arabia certainly doesn't want that. I mean, the first thing Iran could do was attack Mecca with a nuke, and then you got the end of times.
Right, exactly right. And of course, they're not going to admit to doing it, are they? They're not going to say, oh, yeah, we're building a nuclear weapon. Oh. Of course, we are. It's kind of naive, isn't it, in the extreme? But the problem is, though, for me, is that the way that the West, as you say, has been appeasing for such a long time, you know, in the end, you wonder whether, you know, a lot of people believe that it was a sort of Russian-induced attack that they brought on Israel over the weekend, that they send in all these drones as a kind of deterrent to the defense system to try and confuse the defense system. Then they come in later with the ballistic missiles. Is that something that sounds plausible to you? And could they do it again, maybe with more success?
Well, I mean, it's definitely plausible. I mean, like I just said a minute ago, 50% of their missiles didn't fire. That alone could be propaganda. Maybe they're tip top.
Right.
But see, you're sending out a jab before you throw the cross. It could be it too. I mean, they do have capabilities. But here's something else people need to realize: Iran is really, really good at lying.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of these people that we seem to believe all the time in the West are also very good at lying as well, as were the Taliban. You know, when we were told, oh, don't worry, the Afghan army's going to stop the Taliban from taking over, and they literally walked in to the capital, Kabul. They didn't get stopped by the army because they paid them off. And everybody went, oh, no, I didn't see that coming.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, that's how you get power. You pay off the people who are allegedly lawmakers or in power or whatever. I mean, everywhere from the top generals in the Afghan army to what China's doing to the politicians in every Western country. I mean, that's what you do, because politicians want power and they want money, and they get both as long as they play by their own rules on the in the back channels. And we just bow our heads and go to work like good little workers.
Yeah, well, we had Oliver Dowden, who you may not have heard of, who's our deputy prime minister, right? And he today announced a review into banning British firms from selling new AI technology to China. You have to say, I'm sorry, Oliver, they've probably already got what we wanted to sell them, because they're probably selling it to us.
Well, yeah, and breaking news, they've already stolen everything. I mean, they've been in New York, in the United States, there's Chinese spies all over the universities. We have them in the government. We had a Chinese spy driving a senator around for 20 years.
Right.
And it's simply one of their tactics that they can instill in the West through things like their AI and TikTok is that if they can call anyone a racist, we're just going to shut up. So you can't say that's a Chinese spy driving the senator around because you're racist. Right. And it shuts us up, because when you can't win an argument, start screaming and calling names. And that's what they do. And they know if they distract us being the West like that, they're doing the whole, watch the fire burn from across the river. And when they're exhausted fighting each other, we'll come in with fresh troops. That's exactly what's happening. I mean, it all comes back to China, but they do have pretty bad friends, too.
They do. And it's hard to believe that it's all happening by accident as well. You know, you have to start wondering how much of this has been planned from quite a long time ago. You know, all the way back to before they gave us COVID. You know, thanks very much indeed. Buy up everybody's debt, give the world a terrible disease, and then, of course, you know, start taking over countries. It's all going well for them.
Oh, it certainly is. And it's not even just give them a terrible disease. Give them a disease, tell their governments to lock them down and see how much crap the public will put up with. And it turns out it's a lot. I mean, we had people sitting in bubbles pretending to type on desks, killing each other for not wearing masks that were useless.
Right.
And someone made up, let's see if we can get dum-dums to stand 6 feet apart. We all did.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I didn't actually, but there we are. Listen, great to talk to you, Rob. Yeah. We must get you back on again. Rob O'Neill, former US Navy SEAL. Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, medicine shortages are causing headaches for patients across the country. We'll be back with some medicine after this. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, a new report has found that the UK is facing a new normal of medicine shortages, believed to be due to global supply issues. The think tank Nuffield Trust claims weakened trade links with the EU are likely to cause further problems in supply chains post-Brexit, and medics are calling the crisis a national health emergency. We've got Principal GP Dr. Dean Eggett with us, and Vincent Nin, of course, who spoke to us before. His son has struggled over the years with various medication shortages. Very good evening to both of you. Vince, nice to see you again, and Dr. Eggett as well. Let me start with you. Is this something that is a hangover from the pre-Brexit warnings that we all had? I mean, they were talking about how when they moved the European Medicines Agency out of London, it was all going to be a terrible disaster, which didn't turn out to be true. I know what Vince's problems have been, getting ADHD medicines for his son, but what's actually going on out there, as far as you know?
Yeah, it's hugely complex, and Brexit does play a role, but it's not the primary role. So medicine shortages are not new, but they're definitely getting worse, and it's really partly because of global events, partly because the way medicines are regulated in the UK, and partly because we're no longer part of the EU, which means that we don't get to have the same priority access to the drugs and stockpiling that the EU has. So when there's a global event and there's a drug shortage or there is an ingredient shortage, we are impacted and we don't have that same insulation that we once had when we were part of the EU.
Right. Vince, let me come to you, because we spoke to you, I'm going to say a few months back, but, you know, time passes so quickly these days. It was a few months back that your son wasn't able to get his hands and you weren't able to get him ADHD medicine that he really badly needed. You were able to get it eventually. What's the situation now? Have you gone back to finding it a struggle again?
Well, he's on his regular... The medication he's got now, he's on that regularly. We have found that the prescriptions can be a little bit delayed at times, and so instead of doing a prescription to order them 1 week before, we're doing it 2 weeks before, just to take up any delay.
Right.
But what happened last October and November was pretty bad for him and for us as a family.
Yes, exactly right. And Dr. Dean, I mean, one of the problems with ADHD medicine, I would imagine, is that an awful lot more people are currently being found to be requiring prescriptions, if you like. Many more people, I think, by a factor of about 100, are saying that they need ADHD medicine. So presumably that can be a contributory factor as well.
It is, yeah. Ironically, that's part of the problem, really, because we don't have a rapid way to increase medicines into the country anymore. So if we have a sudden spike in demand because there's an increase in diagnosis, we can't just say, well, here's a bulk load more for the country. So the people who already get it will get it, and those who have a new diagnosis are unlikely to get it. The problem being, of course, that those who are settled on a drug at some stage will run out. And the advice that we were given, for example, with ADHD medications is either refer them back to psychiatry for advice on what other drug they should get, or talk them through going cold turkey. It's absolutely terrible. And for people like Vince and his family, it's heartbreaking.
Right. And how much of this is a worldwide problem, Dr. Dean, in the sense that it says here that, you know, there's problems in Europe, the US, Australia? You know, is it a manufacturing problem? Are not enough medicines being made?
It genuinely is a global problem, but it's very complex. And I'm going to give you the example of, you may remember a couple of years back, the Evergreen and the Suez Canal. You know, it took one ship getting stuck for global supplies of all sorts of things. And people will remember probably going into shops and seeing that the shops were bare. They weren't necessarily closed. There wasn't necessarily food items. And the drug supply chain is very similar. So it only takes one small shock to the world to have shortages of ingredients or specific drugs. So England, the UK, is not unique with this problem, but our particular problem is also that we're no longer part of that insulation of the EU, of stockpiling medicines to help each other out. And also, we have some ridiculous rules here in the UK, which means that the way drugs flow through the system is not particularly slick, and that makes the situation a great deal worse.
Yeah, exactly right. And Vince, you were able to get the medicines, as you said earlier, for your son Bradley, but I remember we also talked about there was a problem down in Minehead, roughly, you know, sort of near where you live, where GP surgeries are getting shut down as well, which presumably doesn't help the supply chain problem?
That is correct. I mean, it was about 6 weeks ago that it was just announced on Facebook that our GP surgery was shut down by the CQC. No reason was given, and then it was taken over by another company or entity and was started up 2 days later. But it's the whole communication side of the NHS regarding this has been poor to the extreme, where parents have had to fend for themselves and cobble information together. I mean, when I spoke to you last October about this, come the third week of November, we got a letter through the post, which was a photocopied piece of paper stating your child's ADHD medication may be suspended. Please refer to your GP or limit the amount of medication or go cold turkey. Yeah. But how can you have a son that goes cold turkey when it clearly states on his medical records that if he does that, he will have serious side effects? So you're actually harming the child in trying to save medication, which should be provided. There seems to be an incredible lack of foresight and planning on this.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, Dr. Dean, that does give you a sense of how people like Vince are having to deal with this kind of issue when they've got children who do need regular medication, but they can't sometimes find a doctor, they can't find somebody that can prescribe it. If they do, they can't sometimes find the supply that they require. And, I mean, it gives me the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's an awful lot of sort of, you know, just-in-time type arrangements going on here, you know, like you're lucky if you happen to be able to get the prescription filled. You know, I've had issues before with my family where you go to a particular pharmacy and they say, oh, we haven't got any of that at the moment. We can order it for you. Or, you know, try five or six other places and they have the same issue. Or they sometimes say, oh, you know, this particular medicine is in short supply.
Yeah, it feels like the NHS is in free fall at the moment, doesn't it?
I've been
on this programme before, already talking about how disastrous general practice is at the moment. And actually, pharmacy, the pharmaceutical industry and our community pharmacists are having similar problems of being on the brink of collapse. So general practice is on the brink of collapse. Our community pharmacy is on the brink of collapse. And quite frankly, it feels like we're doing the job with our hands tied, because even when you do finally get to see a patient who's been waiting weeks to see you and got through the telephone line, there's no medicine to give them in many cases. So again, Vince has told us about the harrowing stories of his family. And we're seeing this with diabetic patients, with patients with menopause who need HRT medicines, with people with terrible skin conditions who need steroids. This isn't infrequent. This is a daily reality. Yeah. Several times per day, many hours per day are spent with me trying to figure out, well, what do I give my patient if it's not available? Yeah. And similarly, in pharmacies, they're thinking, well, what do I give or what do I advise the doctor if it's just not on the shelves and I can't get it?
So, I mean, just before we go back to Vince, what would be a simple solution to this, if there is one? Is it just more supply, more manufacture? What is it?
There is no simple solution. It requires some thinking ahead. But one of the main problems that we have at the moment in the UK, essentially, is that when the drugs do come into the country, they go to a wholesaler and then it's a free-for-all. Any one individual company can go to the wholesaler and say, well, I'm going to buy that and I'm going to stock up on it and have a stockpile because I want lots of it. There isn't really a way to get the drugs to the pharmacies of where it needs to be. That needs to be sorted. And reimbursement to pharmacies so that those pharmacies who can get to the wholesaler can actually afford to buy the stuff when they're there, because many pharmacies don't stock it in because they can't afford to buy it for the patients.
Right. And Vince, let me just finish up with you. I mean, does anybody talk to Bradley about whether or not you could move off the medication, or is it something that you think he's going to need through his entire life?
I think he's going to need it until he's at least 18 to 21. The positive note is that the medication that he's on now, he's really, really settled. His education is going on leaps and bounds, his behaviour, his whole attitude. So there has been a positive out of this, that the medication he is now being given has worked.
Right.
It's increased the side effects of his appetite have lessened, so he's eating more. So, you know, you turn a negative into a positive. I hope he's not medicated for the rest of his life, but these pills seem to be doing the trick.
Right, brilliant stuff. Well, give me my best. Vince, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and good luck with the family and all of that. Dr. Dean, great to see you as ever. Another problem that we raised some time ago, we'll still keep raising these problems as and when we can to see if we can fix them for people who need something that they're not being given. Exactly. So, coming up, though, you're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Of course, in the next hour, Britain's most expensive coffee. would you pay 265 quid for a cup of Java? And if you say yes, take yourself out and give yourself a street talking to. Find out where after the break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk. We're on TV, we're on radio, online, and of course, we're on your smart speaker. Coming up in this hour, Prince Harry lists the US as his official residence for the very first time, cutting ties with the United Kingdom. How terribly sad. Nike boss John Donoghue has blamed people working from home on poor sales. So get back in the office. Just do it. And Britain's most expensive coffee. A barista in Mayfair is charging a whopping £265 for a cup that's made from Japanese beans. We see them everywhere, on the way to work, on trains, in our offices, on buses, in the university lecture halls, on the dash of every Fiat 500, grandiose cups of elaborate, overdressed, overpriced coffee. It seems wherever you look, the cafe culture millennials and Gen Z layabouts, the children of Blair's Britain, they're all in love with the image and upper echelon elegance of coffee. In Mayfair, would you believe, a clean conscience coffee shop describing itself as a bar will now flog you the creme de la creme of sophisticato sips for £265, right? Yes, this shot of coffee from the allegedly rare and hard-to-grow Japanese bean has become the most expensive coffee in the entire world. And, of course, the ultimate status symbol for the Islington elite. The beans themselves are bought for 1,500 quid a kilo, which means the markup is extravagant, but it's all worth it to show you voted Remain, love Lily Allen, read The Guardian, and are shaking with excitement for net zero. Heaven help us. Later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Sun newspaper. And they've got a story that I think will interest an awful lot of people. And it's on their page 23, all the way back there. But it's traders hit by the economy. And it says, white van man's £14,000 down the pan. Britain's army of tradesmen and women have taken a massive £14,000 hit to their turnover in the past year. According to figures, the average takings for white van grafters dropped 17% from 82,000 down to 68,000. And they've got everything from builders down 1% to dryliners down 12%, flooring contractors down 8%, 5% down for glaziers, 5% down for electricians, 3% down for bedroom, bathroom and kitchen fitters. And there was a time, of course, during COVID, when an awful lot of people were fixing up their houses and spending quite a bit of money because they weren't spending it on much else, particularly not spending it on commuting. But that bubble would appear to have burst, I'm afraid. So bad news if you're in the trade game, because it's going to get more expensive for you to do that job because of all the fees that you have to pay for congestion charging and EULAs and all the rest of it. And now it looks like you're not making as much money either. Still, spare a thought for Prince Harry. He's officially ditched the UK for the United States to name it as his primary country of residence. This comes after years of the Sussexes living stateside since they downed tools and fled to California in 2020. Joining me now from Los Angeles is the host of the To Die For Daily podcast, the wonderful Kinsey Schofield. Kinsey, very good to see you once more. I'm sorry about this. You know, I feel in some way responsible that we've chased Harry away and now he's decided to make his main residence in your country, for which you must not be really eternally grateful.
Yeah, Mike, thoughts and prayers. Well, you know, I think that we should stress that he's not a U.S. citizen, though. Right. You know, this is just technically a piece of paper. I do think it alludes to the fact that we can let go of any hope that he would return to the British royal family to help support throughout their time of need or whatever those headlines have been recently. But he is not an American citizen, according to the Immigration and Naturalization Act. If he decides to become one, he would be forced to renounce his title or any sort of order of nobility that he holds before he could acquire that citizenship. And that is the only thing that gives him credibility in the United States. Mike, that is both him and Meghan Markle's moneymaker. Right. So he's not going to give up that title for citizenship.
Right. We've talked about this before as well, because at some point or other, certainly if he's a resident, I know a little bit about this because I lived in America for nearly 10 years back in days long before you were born, lived in New York City. And I paid my taxes there. I paid my federal taxes there as well. And I had a visa to work as a journalist in the US. But because of that, I think I could have chosen if I wanted to pay my taxes in the UK, but I didn't. He, at some point, if he's resident there, will be forced to pay some kind of tax, won't he?
He will, and they've been very savvy in the way that they've set up all of their businesses in Delaware, which is not where they live or have really anything to do with.
Right.
So they've set up everything that they do in Delaware for that nice little tax break. So that is clearly something that is on their radar, taxes.
Yes, because for those of the audience who are not familiar with Delaware, it's a bit like launching all your businesses offshore. It's kind of like having them in the Isle of Man or somewhere like that, or even in the Netherlands or somewhere where the taxes are very, very limited, which doesn't quite chime, does it, with their responsible ownership of various charities and monies that they should be passing on to good causes like the government. But in terms of why he's done this, I suppose, inevitably, if he hadn't done it, he wouldn't really be in a good position. Because you can't continue to stay in America forever, even if you're married, unless you become a resident, right?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think that the reason we've seen these papers and that address on the papers, specifically the date that he got the boot from Frogmore Cottage, I do think he's making a statement there. This is another pity party from Prince Harry, because he's told Good Morning America he's considered becoming a U.S. citizen, but it wasn't a high priority for him. He was really defiant in his engagement with Anderson Cooper, saying, why should he renounce his titles? What difference would that make? If he wanted to be a citizen of the United States, he would be one by now. He would shut down this whole, you know, gigantic mess of the Heritage Foundation back and forth. He could stop all of that.
He could. And I'm told that the date that he decided that he wanted to be listed as an American resident was, in fact, the date that he left Frogmore Cottage. So the date that he was effectively kicked out, lock, stock and barrel, by his old man, I suppose you might say. It was June 29th of last year. That's the date he said he started having the USA as his main residence. But they didn't go straight to the USA then, did they? I thought they went straight to Vancouver Island, didn't they?
That's right. They went to Canada and we all thought that that's where they were going to stay. And it wasn't until Tyler Perry offered up his home in America right before the pandemic hit that Harry and Meghan packed their bags and moved into Tyler Perry's mansion for free for quite a bit of time. But I think that the ultimate objective for Meghan was always to get back to the States and to, you know, just revert back to her influencer lifestyle, which is what we've seen so far.
And how has that been going since the last time we spoke a couple of nights ago, the selling of the jam?
Can I be sassy really quick? Can
Please.
I just have a little with you, Mike. So the Prince of Wales was seen today in Surrey visiting Surplus to Supper. Yes. This is a nonprofit organization that distributes surplus food to people in need. Media-wise, this was a highly anticipated event, as this is Prince William's first appearance since the Princess of Wales revealed her preventative cancer treatment.
Yeah.
Meghan Markle's friend today and a charity named Alliance of Moms, a community of women supporting pregnant and parenting teens in foster care, they posted a series of pictures of Meghan Markle today on Instagram. Now, Meghan would have given her permission for these images to go up, images that would distract from Prince William's efforts to support Surplus to Supper, images that could have easily been uploaded yesterday or tomorrow. And I think this is just another example of the kind of tug of war that was constantly happening between the Sussexes and the Cambridges, now the Wales, right, prior to Megxit. Meghan refusing to acknowledge the system in place, the clear schedule to amplify certain projects and executions, which are highly strategized months in advance to ensure they receive the support that they need.
Right.
You know, she doesn't recognize oversaturing the news cycle weakens the royal family's authority, or she does, you know, right, now that she's not one, she doesn't care. But, you know, this is just, it almost gives credibility to that South Park episode, that, you know, that the me right, element of that South Park episode, that during the royals' time of real stress and concern, Meghan announces new Netflix shows. She's posting jam on Instagram and now, you know, smiling for photos in these T-shirts. It just feels like me. She's back. There's no hiding.
And as I say, I said to you the other night, those videos, little clips from the polo match and the prize giving afterwards, and, you know, her sort of putting herself front and centre and all of that. And I always say to people who say, oh, you know, you media people are just always picking on her, she's not like that, you know, she doesn't plan these things in the same way as you describe. Well, just think about it the other way around, because if she, in fact, didn't plan these things at all, and imagine her surprise so many times when she's launched things on the very same day that somebody in the UK was doing something completely different. And I'm afraid it happens too many times. And you know that she would not allow that to happen by accident. She wouldn't say, oh, my God, how is it possible that we issued this picture when this other picture was coming out, you know, of the Prince and Princess of Wales or something like that? You know, it doesn't bear thinking about. It would never happen.
She's not that stupid. I mean, I would say Prince Harry might be, but yeah, Meghan Markle is not that stupid. You don't go from cable TV actress to the Duchess of Sussex by being a stupid individual. I think she's incredibly intelligent, and she does do these things on purpose because she's, you know, her ultimate objective is to make a buck off these people who she believes have hurt her feelings.
Right. Exactly. And I mean, there's so many things that are going to happen over the course of the next few months, I dare say, that, as you suggest, there will be all manner of revelations, I'm sure, that they'll have ready. And they'll have timed all of the, you know, Netflix deals and all of the announcements about that and all of the release dates of all of that around everything else that they know is happening.
Exactly. And if you're alluding to what I think you're alluding to, I don't think that they're going to walk away looking like decent human beings.
No. No, of course they're not. And that, unfortunately, is how they are going to be. But I do feel that, you know, we do give Harry a hard time on here. He appeared on Plank of the Week again this week for his unfortunate inability to win any kind of lawsuit whatsoever, and for costing not only his own household £1 million, but for trying to pass it off to the taxpayers in this country. So you might be able to hear the refrain of this world's smallest violin, which we brought in especially for him. But in terms of the lovely Meghan, how is she and her sort of jam and all the rest of it being received? What are people saying over there?
A pretty scathing reaction, if I'm being honest. You know, you wait such a long time to reveal what your next moves are, and it's labels peeling off a DIY jar of jam.
Right.
It's not really what people anticipated from her. They wanted more. So I think that I don't think anybody's impressed, if I'm being honest with you.
No. And let's go back to Prince William just for the final suggestion about what's going on. He was given Get Well Soon cards, as you said, when he was out delivering these Surplus to Supper food distribution parcels. And obviously nobody really knows how well she's doing. Nobody really knows how her recovery is coming along. But he promised to look after her.
So sweet. Yeah, I mean, I hear that and my heart falls into my stomach. I do think that we've seen that Prince William prioritizes his family over the crown over the last few months.
Yes.
So while we don't know what's going on with the Princess of Wales, the fact that we saw him today, we saw him in good spirits, he showed up, you know, he was engaging and charming with everybody there. I do believe that is a good result and that we can take that and it should give us some peace knowing that the Princess of Wales is hopefully feeling okay at home and recuperating and improving as best as she can under the circumstances. Because we do know, we saw him pull out of the memorial service for his godfather. When things are bad at home, he does not hesitate to prioritize his family. So it's great. It's wonderful when we see him out and about and in good spirits, kind, happy, and just so generous with his time.
Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, after all the ridiculous shenanigans that went on a few weeks back about her health and whether we'd see her again, I mean, I suppose the one thing that has changed since the last couple of weeks is that the Easter holidays are now over, the children will be going back to school. And again, I think most people would, in this country anyway, are no longer interested in how she is. They just want her to be okay.
Right. I definitely think that the question mark over everything is been buried and done. I mean, I'm seeing, though, I wouldn't say people aren't worried about how she's doing, because I am seeing a flood of people posting the reactions that they have received from the palace, because they, you know, took the time to send letters to her telling, I even have people writing me saying, you know, I lost my hair during chemo. How can I send her all of the tips and tricks that I use to keep some of my hair? The way that people feel about this person, it's incredible. They are so emotionally connected to Catherine, the Princess of Wales. They are invested in her health and her future. And I think it's because she is so authentic and sincere in everything she does.
Yeah, I think so. Great to talk to you, Kinsey, as ever. Have a good weekend. Thank you very much indeed. Kinsey Schofield from the host of the To Die For podcast. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, pothole chaos. Officials say Britain's roads are at breaking point with funding still miles away. Stay where you are. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Plank of the Week returns tomorrow night from 7 p.m. only here, of course, on Talk TV. Here's a little snippet of what you can expect. Let's go to Humza Useless and see what he's got to say for himself.
I love this clip.
You know, it
just keeps
time.
Giving. Just
never gets old. Never gets old.
Works. Let's have another look. Sam, for those who didn't catch it the last 55 times. Yeah,
please.
Let's do it.
Can we do it in slow-mo?
Well, I'd like to, actually, yeah. It's brilliant. This is when he decided to show off on his scooter.
Oh,
he actually asked for a camera.
How can he muck that up?
God. He's also, the funniest thing about it is that apparently he'd asked for a photographer to be in the corridor with him to show off about how brilliant he was.
It was actually pre-planned.
Yes, so the photographer was actually asked to be there.
Yeah.
So that he could capture it. There we are. Terribly unfair, of course. Every time Humza Useless gets a nomination, which is quite frequently, we just play it every single time. But
glorious.
We'll come back to Scotland because we've got things to talk about net zero up there. But come on, it's another day and another chance for the BBC to broadcast its own stupidity. The corporation is about to face one of its most high-profile tribunals since it lost a gender pay dispute with Newswatch presenter Samira Ahmed in 2020. But because that alone isn't embarrassing enough for the BBC, they're going to court with someone... They're not going to court with someone credible. That would be ridiculous. No, they're going to war with Martine Croxall, the presenter who was taken off air for acting like she'd just won the lottery minutes after the news broke that Boris Johnson had pulled out of the race to become Prime Minister.
Well, this is all very exciting, isn't it? Hello and welcome to our look ahead to what the papers will be bringing us tomorrow. Am I allowed to be this gleeful? Well, I am.
Well, you're not, actually, no. The fleets of viewers who complain to Ofcom clearly think BBC impartiality is a joke. And by the sounds of it, so does Martine. Well, rather than keeping her head down, she's now amongst five female presenters suing for age discrimination, sex discrimination and unequal pay. She and other colleagues were told to reapply for a small pool of chief presenter roles after it was announced that the corporation's home and world news channels would be merged in April of last year. They claim they were unfairly selected for redundancy and declined voluntary redundancies and for a time were left without job titles. But as the presenters were all due to return, they all continue to receive their full pay package. Well, her work woes don't seem to have stopped her enjoying her time off. She seems to have had a pretty gleeful year out, smiling her way around the world, skiing in Bulgaria, feeding elephants in Thailand, and taking hot air balloon rides, presumably fueled by her own unlimited supply of hot air. Well, good luck getting anyone to take you seriously, Martine, because you're going to need it. Now, let's bring the panel back in. Sam is back, Samantha is back as well, and you don't have a name that begins with S-A-M, unfortunately.
I don't, isn't that awful?
But you can, if you wish, do your little thing. Andrew Eborn is here. Are we going to get it? There you go. Pathetic, isn't it?
Oh, that was like Sharon Smith's show on the West End.
Well, I could be the other Sam Smith, because you've got Samantha Smith, haven't we? We've got to get confused people.
You're exactly a minority right. In here.
For I am a minority.
White male is a minority.
It's true, a white heterosexual male, whatever next on television.
Yeah, I did,
that's what you say.
And I did bleach my hair in the pandemic and put on a little poundage. And, and my partner did say, you're looking a bit Sam Smith.
I dyed my hair grey, especially to make it sort of diverse enough.
And it makes you look so intelligent.
Thank you. It's a whole terrible deceptive.
You guys just carry on chatting amongst yourselves. Something's happening on this show. I don't know. He starts asking Henry Bolton questions about migrants. What's going on? Anyway, listen, Martine Croxall, you said you liked her. I think she made a complete fool of herself. But the great thing about the BBC is that these people, and she's been there, believe it or not, 30-plus years.
Yes.
She got her first job at the BBC as a work experience person at BBC Radio Leicester. Oh, okay. And the problem that I have with people in the BBC is that's the only job they ever have. Mm. They go to the BBC sort of as a man and boy, or whatever it is, or girl, or non-binary individual, and then they just stay there for life, for years and years and years.
I have to say, I've worked for the BBC like as a temp. But like I remember being.
I've done shows at the BBC.
I remember wishing that I was there longer because it's auntie. Do you know what I mean? It's an all encompassing big kind of corporate hub.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be though. It should be a commercial organisation like everybody else.
It should have been. I do feel bad for Martine because I think she is a good news reader.
A great news. And what I love about her,
feel free to interrupt us, Matt, because they like to just, you know, these mansplaining
types.
I'll
let him have his moment.
I mean? Feel free to
finish up, Andrew. Let Sam speak.
I remember that I was watching it just before we came in, and it was that gleeful moment. And she was giggling all about Boris Johnson, who just pulled out the leadership race when they were going to be doing the Sunday papers, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it worked on that sort of basis. But also, I mean, a good friend of mine, Mariam, you remember the countdown thing that she did fairly recently?
Oh, yeah.
And these things go viral.
Right.
But the difficulty is this. So the last difficulty is this. Is they used to have two separate things doing news, didn't they? Mm. And they effectively merged it into one. And they basically said people have to reapply for the job.
Yeah.
The allegation.
It's perfectly normal
practice. The issue is with Martine's allegations is that, yes, as you've said, she was a fantastic newsreader, but the moment she stopped being a newsreader was the moment that she inserted herself into personal, partisan political affairs. And, you know, her display on that nightly news programme was, I think, the beginning of the end for her. Right. Not because she was aging, not because she had been there so long, not because they were discriminating against her, but because her primary function as a newsreader had been undermined by no one but herself.
Right.
And there have been cases where, you know, female presenters, especially in the business, have been taken off air due to age. In Canada, there was a famous example recently of Lisa Laflamme, the CTV anchor who successfully, I believe, sued Bell Media for age discrimination. But Martine here, I don't think there's anyone that is really believing that she was taken off because 55 is too old.
Yeah.
I would have said she could easily look like she's in her early 40s.
Yeah.
The issue is that she undermined her own credibility and could not be trusted to read the news when she displayed such a flagrant disregard for the impartiality rules that we and other, you know, Talk TV, GB News, etc. are expected to abide by.
Yeah, why exactly right. Ofcom are always all over anyone who says something which they think they shouldn't have said in the role that they've particularly got, particularly if it's at GB News or if it's here. But at the BBC, you very rarely hear of anybody actually complaining about that.
Well, because at here and GB News, people presenters freely talk about their own thoughts and their.
Yeah, but she wasn't a presenter. She's a newsreader.
So what you're saying is that Talk TV and GB News, it's just presenters, whereas they have
to
abide.
Well, it's a different job.
So they have, exactly, it's a different job.
It's a different job.
Exactly.
But I don't remember, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember Ofcom issuing any statement about what she did.
No.
She was taken off air by the BBC.
Yes.
Nevertheless, though, if that had been somewhere like this...
If you look at Channel 4, do you remember Krishnamurti, I believe it was, that called a senior Tory MP's a see you next Tuesday on air?
Right.
And yet he was allowed to return to his job
Didn't he mean to say Hunt?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah,
well, the BBC all do that.
Sure.
I mean, there's a tape of them all doing it. Now, I've said Jeremy Hunt many times.
Yes.
I've never called him the wrong word.
Mm-hmm. No.
But they do it, I'm sure, absolutely deliberately. And they wouldn't do it to a Labour Party.
Sure.
And they wouldn't face the sort of repercussions that if you had done that, you would be off on
well,
the
look at Nick
side.
Robinson. Nick Robinson this week on the Today programme, interviewing David Cameron, refers to Israel murdering innocent civilians in Palestine. And you go, sorry? And he issued this very mealy-mouthed apology in which he said he should have been clearer in the words that he used. Yeah. Clearly anti-Semitic, what he said.
Yeah.
They're not murdering civilians.
No, and it's absolutely right to call it that. I think it's important to point out that this case is not about the gleeful comment.
No, it's not.
But it's
all about everything's related. But everything's related.
And I think that this, the issue that, you know, the case that's being brought is a very legitimate one, and there are real issues with sexism in the mainstream media and the way that women seem to have a shorter shelf life as broadcasters or presenters than their male counterparts. But Martine is not the person to be spearheading this, considering that she has her own scandals surrounding her time as a newsreader that have, I would say, muddied the waters
also,
of her ability to claim age discrimination.
I was going to say, but she is correct in the fact that men end up being on television until they decide to go in their 70s or whatever. Whereas women, for example, like you only need to look at Strictly, with Brucey knocking 80, and obviously Tess like in her 30s or 40s, whatever. So there is sexism rife. So I do understand, but obviously with the joking and laughing about Boris, that's a different thing.
Like. But also the thing about this issue is that they do in all sorts of media businesses slim down, expand.
Yes.
They have to cut their cloth accordingly. Mm. Yeah. She's been there, as I say, more than 30 years. She was probably offered a pretty good redundancy deal, better than anybody would get offered from a commercial company. Mm. She turned it down, and now she's complaining that she got sidelined. Yeah. Yet she's been on full pay, as you say, tramping around the world, having a very nice time. I don't really care, but it's our money at the end of the day. Mm. And there isn't, I don't think, any other job that you can have in any other media organisation like that.
Yeah.
Because when you're in with the BBC, you're in with the furniture.
Yeah.
They just don't, get rid of people.
Well, that's all the
information is going to come out. I think the trial starts on the 1st of May.
Yes.
So all of this will come out on that sort of basis. But it's also the question is, they were saying they asked to apply for a job.
Yeah.
And what the allegation, which again will come out, whether it's true or not, the allegation was they'd already decided which presenters they were going to have. So getting people to do the dance.
But it happens all the time.
Of course it does.
I mean, I've done many redundancy exercises in my career at the newspaper built business. And you have a certain number. Management says you've got to lose this number of people.
Yes.
If enough of them don't volunteer, you're going to have to figure out who you're going to get rid of.
And I always say it's really important.
And you don't want to be left with all the dregs.
No, exactly. But I always think it's important that people should be treated with respect. Mm. So whenever they do,
I disagree with that entirely. It's been the downfall of this nation. Treating people with respect is a very bad idea.
I have to say
it's gone too far.
Within our nation, you only need to look over to American politics right now with the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene, etc. They have lost civility, and which is something that we do have still. Like never even.
I think we've gone the same way.
Maybe in the public space, in places like Twitter, I'm literally writing an article about this at the moment, but like if you look at PMQs, for example, there's still a kind of jovialness about it. There isn't this kind.
It's quite civilised.
We love a pantomime.
It's still civilised, is what I'm saying.
But you also need to fact check. And so when Keir Starmer sort of says, the billionaire, Rishi Sunak, and somebody corrects, well, he's not quite a billionaire, unless you add a lot of the
other... Like Samantha says, it's panto. It's panto.
Oh, no, it isn't. Where's your career?
Also, you did see this week, didn't you, Wes Streeting and his fellow front bench Labour Party shadow cabinet members laughing at the possibility that people like Nigel Farage were being sort of locked up over in Brussels for having what was supposedly a conference about, right-wing views.
I
think it has shifted a little bit. But let's talk about Scotland, because there's a lot going on up there at the moment. Scotland ditches net zero. This is a great story. It's the first thing that I think Humza Useless has actually got right, because he's finally... So the Scottish government, believe it or not, was the first government in the world to set out the net zero targets, right? And of course, they famously had COP26, where Alok Sharma burst into tears.
Great whiskey, by the way, when you had that.
That
guy
was good
on.
Whiskey, yeah.
Oh, I love that.
I gave it to my son.
How long did that last?
So I think he still hasn't. I don't think he's finished it yet. It's 800 quid's worth of whiskey.
It was.
Wow.
Really
nice.
Anyway, they've apparently decided they're so useless at hitting the targets, even though they've reduced. Because Britain has actually reduced its targets by 50% in about 20 years. They're saying now we can't hit the target, so we're just going to forget about it.
Yeah.
Well, we're just not going to do net zero.
But they're saying they're forgetting about the immediate target. Yeah. But they still reckon they're going to hit it once by 2040 or whatever.
2040. Yeah, but they won't, will they?
I mean, we saw something similar with the Labour Party and Keir Starmer essentially truncheoning his billion pound, well, multi-billion pound net zero
plan.
Exactly. What we're seeing is the great net zero lie unraveling, which is that, you know, many governments and politicians have used the myth of net zero to try and push through policies and plans that they would otherwise not have the support for. Because if you can put it under climate change and global warming and net zero, then people are more likely to push it through. I mean, look at Sadiq Khan and what essentially is punishing poor people for not having new enough cars.
Right.
That's what his whole ULEZ scheme is in essence.
Yes.
But, you know, whether it's the Labour Party or Hunza Yousaf in Scotland, what we're seeing is those who utilise and exploited net zero and climate change to achieve their policy ends are now being told to pay the piper and being asked, where's the progress? Well,
because
where
it's an imaginary, dreamed up sort of target anyway, right?
Yes.
And they've also worked out that it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
Because, to be honest, if we had, as we have done, as we're told, we've reduced our global emissions by 50% in this country, why hasn't it stopped all of the problems? And apparently it hasn't.
Well, obviously,
it's almost as though the climate is not affected by
the climate problem is obviously huge, and it isn't left and it isn't right. I mean, you only need to look at Dubai this week and to see
that. Do you know why that happens in Dubai?
But there is.
Do you know what they do in Dubai? Do you know what they do?
They
seed the clouds to get more rain, and they have no drainage.
Exactly.
So you have to play with the weather. What you can do is go back to 1960 and see what the weather used to be like in Dubai then. Oh, no, you can't, because there was no Dubai.
So you're saying it was chemtrails?
The issue
No, it's not chemtrails, but they seed the clouds because they want more water.
It was banned.
My daughter lives there. I know how Dubai works.
Exactly.
They have no drainage whatsoever. And they've had several incidents like this. This is like the worst one. But over the past sort of several months, they've had terrible problems with drainage because they haven't built any.
Talking about the Middle East and China and Russia, you know, the biggest issue with net zero and climate change policies that I have and many others have is that you can demonize ordinary people. You can push these oppressive policies onto us in the West, in America, in the UK, in France, in Germany. But the issue is that no matter how much we reduce our carbon emissions and our net zero, our carbon footprint, as long as China, the Middle East, and Russia are continuing to create 70, 80, 90, 100% times larger emissions than we've ever put out.
China's argument is that they are 30 years in the past. So China's argument is they still have like decades
China is selling everything that they make to the rest of the world, right? We have got idiots in this country who think that we've somehow passed on our climate emissions to them just because they're killing our manufacturing.
Colonialism.
And I mean, they are far advanced of anything that we do in their economy. So the idea that they should have special dispensation to have more coal-fired power stations is absolutely rubbish.
But saying that they're not doing it so we don't have to do it isn't really.
Republic of Mike Graham. What he says goes.
But it is a real thing. We all do agree, surely, that climate change is a real thing and that the human beings and our place on this planet is destructive.
And the independent Republic of Mike Graham...
I don't think you can prove that at all. Yeah. There's no evidence whatsoever that our place on this planet is destructive.
You only need to look at the graphs since the Industrial Revolution.
The graphs are all models, right?
Yeah.
They were not measuring these things for more than about 200 years. Mm. Yes, they can go back and go into the ground and stick, you know, poles into volcanoes to see what used to happen. But at the end of the day, we have been alive on this planet for a tiny, minuscule amount of the time that the planet's been alive.
Mm. Exactly.
The idea that we're so arrogant that we think we can kill it all off just because we're driving around in diesel cars is nonsensical.
I think that the issue that many people, again, have isn't... You know, the majority of people who don't believe in the climate change and net zero targets aren't climate deniers. They aren't, you know, they aren't right-wing extremists. They are ordinary people who want to put food on the table, keep a roof over their heads, send their kids to a good school and go to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and live a decent life.
Yeah.
And for politicians in their ivory towers to be essentially penalising and punishing ordinary people for the decisions and the mistakes that they have made is... Yeah. Well,
that's the point.
And we're up to COP 29 now. Well, yeah, we've had 29 of them. Nothing has changed.
Agreed, but I think that's the point with Scotland, you know, reneging, etc., and what they said they were going to do. The cost of living crisis has overtaken everything else. So people see climate change problems as nothing to do.
I need
to pay for my groceries.
Exactly. And if you ask people about climate change, they'll give you a very nice virtue signaling answer.
Yeah, of
but
course.
As soon as you say, would you mind giving me an extra 10 quid
to
pay for it, they don't want to.
It's absolutely right, and you work on that. And politicians are in the business of getting re-elected, so it's great to give somebody else a target and say, we're going to stop it now, but by 2040, and they would have all long gone, and although I still hope that you'll still be showing that brilliant video
Well, I mean, he may not be in power by that stage, but I mean, what I can tell you is that they've already got plans for the Azerbaijan COP 29.
Yes, of
which is going to be taking place in November. And they've also got plans for COP 30.
Yes.
So 29 won't be the end of it. Yep. 30 is in Brazil.
Let's be clear,
it's a fair COP. Yeah. You've got to keep going.
Get your private planes ready.
Yeah,
they haven't scrapped net zero. They've given themselves more time to be able to enact even more policies on people that will have far-reaching consequences.
Yeah.
They're just extending their
own
ability.
It's like that old Henny Youngman joke, who you'll know, but you guys are probably too young to know. He was a very funny American comedian. He said, you hear about the guy who had a terminal illness. The doctor gave him 6 months to live. He said, 6 months later, he was still alive, gave him another 6 months so he could pay the bill. And that's, what it is. Let's talk about working from home.
Yes.
Because Dowler's probably in favour of that as well. John Donohoe, who is the head of Nike, has complained that actually their whole company's profits have now been damaged.
Of course.
Finally, somebody's admitted it. Because everyone's working from home. Sales slump in 2 years.
Absolutely. And you're not going to use your trainers. And I'm surprised, actually, the statistics of people wearing trousers. Same sort of thing. When you had your Zoom thing, you didn't need to wear anything underneath working on that sort of basis.
I'm not being funny, but surely if you're working from home, you're pretty much wearing your Nike trainers. And you go out for a run at lunchtime, you're more likely.
Yeah, but as Andrew says, no, you're not going out for a run. And no, you're not stimulated. Exactly. You're just lying there in your pyjamas. As little work as possible. And one of the reasons that he's saying that they haven't had as much innovation is not just because people are working from home and not sort of buying more shoes.
Yeah.
It's just the creative process,
so
which goes on.
Nike are the problem.
Yeah. Yes, because they've been working from home, and so the fact is they've not been as creative. Because when you're not mixing in a work environment, you don't come up with the ideas.
Yeah.
You don't sit in coffee rooms and sit in meeting rooms and actually come up with stuff that you should be doing.
And I'm surprised they didn't actually blame Sunak because of wearing trainers and things like that.
Well, that was Adidas,
wasn't it?
Did Sunak apologise? I was at a friend's house who is a fashion influencer. The other day, she was like, "Oh, my shoes are ruined." I can't wear them.
I can't imagine why so many people suddenly pick on one thing and then they all have to wear it.
I don't
understand that.
That's called fashion.
It's called being a complete sheep.
But people are sheep. This is why influencers, and I understand there's a conference going down in Devon in the next few days. It's true. And they have to do that because you don't want to feel this missing out.
It's the same as
really missing out if you've got different trainers, surely.
It's the same as the catalogues of the 1960s to hark back to your generation.
Yeah.
The Gretan
trends catalog. have always been a thing, but with social media and with the rise of TikTok and Instagram and all of these micro influencers who are all trying to push their products onto you and are furthered by an algorithm, we are seeing a trend towards, you know, this toxic inclusion mindset. But when it comes to the Nike story, I would say, as a young person, as someone who is, you know, many of my friends are starting out as graduates now in the workforce. They're working in the city or they're working in Manchester or wherever. I think that the pandemic and the work from home mentality has been one of the most damaging things for young people's work.
I've been saying it for years.
To have ever come out of 2020. Mm. For, you know, you look at Canary Wharf, for example, the financial and legal hub of the United Kingdom. Most major law firms and financial firms are having to move out of the city. You have to move out into cheaper, smaller areas because they just cannot get bums on seats.
But also, and, right. But also with young people, like you said, like I was with a bunch of influencers recently, and they were younger, but they couldn't.
Were they wearing trainers?
But they couldn't. No, but they couldn't string a sentence together with for one on one. They're used to they're used to interacting with their phones, but not interacting with a human being.
Exactly. That will kill off the human race.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll end up growing a third opposable thumb or something, so that you can text quicker.
But I love that. And people say in signs and in a restaurant, there was somebody with their little daughter, and they did this, and the daughter turned to the father and said, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Because obviously people don't do that anymore.
Right.
I've got to tell you one more story before we go.
Yes.
It sort of tickled me earlier on. This is Joe Biden. He's famous for telling stories that aren't particularly true, right, because he gets mixed up. But apparently he was down in a place called Scranton, Pennsylvania, visiting a war memorial, and there was a lot of names, you know, from the Second World War. And his uncle, apparently, was a guy who was Second Lieutenant Ambrose J. Finnegan, who was lost over New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, during the Second World War. He flew single-engine planes. They never found him. They found his plane. And do you know what he said, Joe Biden? This is going to amaze you. I hope it will, anyway. He says that he believes that he may have been eaten by cannibals.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not joking. Well, this is the leader of the free world. Right?
But I think
steak and pygmy, absolutely. Right.
And also, if we compare that to the things that Trump has said, who says he's Jesus and, you know, when he's Nelson Mandela, I think...
Well,
like,
he's never said that any of his relatives were eaten by cannibals.
But again, this is one thing that I will say about this country. We would not stand. We would not stand for our two main candidates to be in their 80s.
That wouldn't
near
work.
70s.
It wouldn't work over
here.
It's
extraordinary. It would never happen in this country.
That's why they get stuck in the Lords.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, they can marinate over
Although,
there,
you know, I do remember a time, I think you might remember this, Andrew, when did Anne Widdecombe not suggest that one of her relatives had been eaten by cannibals?
Oh, no, absolutely.
In Papua New Guinea.
She'd eaten them, that's why.
But I do think it's interesting. If this were, you know, where Joe Biden made this comment, we're all having a giggle about it. It's very, very funny, you know, an old man telling a silly story. But on the flip side of it, and this is what you're talking about when it comes to the deep divisions within American society and even British to an extent. If this conversation had been happening about Trump on a left-wing broadcast, they would have been branding him racist. They would have been calling for him to be castrated and hung up on the, you know, the temple of George Washington or Abraham Lincoln statue. Exactly.
And his popularity would go through the roof
again.
The more you throw at him...
It's interesting to see the dichotomy of how left-wing political figures and right-wing political figures are treated within today's society.
Absolutely right. And the same you could say about Liz Truss. You know, she got treated in a way that I don't think any left-wing politician would have treated. That's another story. If you haven't already heard, Talk is going digital. Here's how you can watch, listen and get involved from Monday, the 29th of April.
Very good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
The home of big opinions.
Oh, don't start me on that.
Straight talking.
There's a sort of feeling they ought to look as if they're doing something.
And no nonsense.
So don't accuse anyone else of stoking culture wars.
Is going digital.
Such as the smoke and mirrors of politics.
Make sure you're ready.
But the government's got to be more flexible.
From the end of April, listen to Talk on Radio via DAB or your smart speaker. Or watch live on YouTube on your connected TV.
Beard.
I don't know who that bloke was at the end. you're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, we'll be taking a trip to the world of woke, to where another Scottish story, primary schools are appointing children as young as 4 as LGBT champions. See you shortly for one more round. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The world of woke.
Now, when my kids were 4, they were kicking a football about and learning how to spell. Most of them knew how to spell, actually. But what they're doing now was not being appointed as LGBT champions, insisting they were gay and going around asking other kids if they were transgender. But that's exactly what LGBT Youth Scotland wants our children to do, primary school children, to be precise. The charity somehow managed to get hold of nearly £1 million in taxpayers' money last year, almost half of that from the Scottish Government, with the rest from local authorities and the NHS. And it spends that money going around Scotland running some sort of woke competition where schools hoping to obtain gold status are required to transform their schools into what sound like LGBT boot camps. Each school joining the scheme is told it must appoint at least two pupils and two staff members as LGBT champions. Urged to ask pupils if they are part of the LGBT community, they're told to provide evidence of their LGBT safe spaces, such as gender-neutral laboratories and PE classes, to ensure their school uniform is inclusive and even to put up the organisation's posters and rewrite school policies, undertaking at least one activity which specifically addresses the needs of transgender young people, such as conducting a campaign that addresses trans rights is also required to win that all-important gold award. Oh, and the cherry on top, LGBT Youth Scotland is charging these schools up to £2,000 for the privilege of being told what to do. It's a world beyond woke. It's completely insane. At this age, children's curious brains are ripe for education, but they're also vulnerable to manipulation. We drop our kids off at school knowing the teachers have a duty of care, but this organisation wants to force children to trade sexual identities like playing cards, declaring and performing them as though something as adult and private as who you want to have sex with is as appropriate for a four-year-old as whether you prefer jam or chocolate spread. In 1932, readers would have shuddered when Aldous Huxley described children being encouraged to engage in erotic play in his dystopian novel Brave New World. Less than a century later, who'd have thought it could be mistaken for the curriculum at a Scottish primary school? Satire reads more like foreshadowing every day. And that is The World of Woke.
The World of Woke.
My panel is still here, the two Sams and Andrew. That's what I'm going to call you.
Yellow.
It's becoming...
Sam Squared.
It's becoming a little bit of a money-making exercise, this LGBT stuff. It's a bit like net zero. Yeah. You know, let's all make as much money as possible, regardless of how we do it.
Yeah, but you're right, it is crazy. Mm. I mean, children at the age of
four... Come on.
Yeah, children at the age of four, let them just be children.
Yeah.
You don't need to impose... There should be no hidden gender or public ones at that sort of age either.
Exactly.
You need to work on that sort of basis. And what happens... We were talking about this earlier in the break. We talk in the break as well. What I love about it is that there's the great thing to call out the wrongs in this world, call out the genuine sexism, call out the genuine prejudice. When you classify everything as racist and everything is prejudicial, you are devaluing the real claims. And that's the abhorrent thing about it.
I think it's more valuable to teach kids that age just that everybody's the same.
Well, yeah, just respect, play.
I think the point is that they're not... You use quite incendiary words, Mike, saying things like force and, you know... No one is or would... get a four-year-old to talk about
Yeah, but you don't
sex,
get the gold standard. It's
stuff.
A bit like the whole Stonewall
thing. You don't get
the mark.
Agreed,
do you?
But speaking as an LGBT person who...
But are you an LGBT champion?
Yes, an LGBTQ person who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I was made to feel... less than, I was made to feel foolish. I was bullied.
Not at four.
Yeah, no, but at four, but at like, at, my mum says she knew I was gay when I was three.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these things that, so, but
you
telling...
You didn't need to know that when you were three.
No, but telling children, like, if I had been told it was okay that I liked other boys, then that would have saved me. That would have saved me from a lot of grief.
You probably didn't know, because at four you're not sexually active.
No, I know.
From the opposite end of the spectrum, I'm barely out of diapers as many presenters as I do remind
me. Andrew.
He's in his man diaper right now.
I don't know.
I thought I could smell something, Andrew.
But I went to an all girls grammar school in leafy Shropshire, you know, about as nice and blue and Tory as it can get, you know, by all accounts and standards. You would think that would be a hub of discrimination and forced bullying and whatever else. In all girls' school, everyone would want to, you know, prove that they're not a lesbian, because that's the stereotype. And yet, I was raised in and went to this school for 7 years, and it was such an open and expressive and welcoming environment, largely in part due to the lack of these forced ideals and forced schemes.
Don't use that.
You know,
way.
We do have a lot of, you know, we have a large LGBT community in my former school. Many girls were bisexual or gay.
Yeah. We had
transgender people,
and
they were exactly, and they were perfectly welcomed. But we didn't need inclusivity schemes and diversity.
And that's the problem.
And I don't. And I think. And I don't. I absolutely don't think you do need them.
I think it should be, Sam, you know as well as I do that all of this stuff gets weaponized by local councils because they get money, and that was my point. It becomes about the money in the end. Let's talk about something else about the money. White Van Man apparently is losing 14,000 quid
average income.
Some people might be surprised at how much they were making. 82,000.
Yeah, amazing.
Some of them were making. Builders, I'm not surprised by this, having had a few builders in from time to time. 115,000 quid a year they were making. They've lost 1%. The biggest drop is dry liners, down 12%.
Dry liners, terrible. Back to those uncomfortable underwear again.
More like a wet liner, really.
Thank you. But electricians, isn't that shocking? I mean, same sort of thing, working on the basis. Mm. The reality is that 14 grand it's down. They haven't really classified how they've done it, when they're sole traders or everything.
Well, their takings, they're saying, are down.
Yes.
Which can only mean that people are spending less money because they haven't got as much money. Yeah. As I know that certainly, Joe, I've said this earlier, during COVID, an awful lot of people had extensions put onto their houses because they had a bit of spare money because they weren't travelling anywhere. Mm. Now I suspect it's the opposite.
Well, building can be seen as a luxury. Like, if you have a problem with your electrics or a problem with your plumbing, then you need somebody to come and help you. You don't necessarily need to have your kitchen remodelled. And especially in a cost of living crisis, obviously people were getting furlough up the wazoo during the pandemic.
So they were like, economy.
Let's just spend on a new kitchen. Now it's not the same.
In times of economic hardship, the famous saying, make do and mend, that's what we as a British society do. Mm. Over the pandemic, we saw the rise of DIY culture, and it wouldn't surprise me if a great deal of people now are turning to YouTube my pipes are leaking, so let's figure out a way to fix it myself rather than calling in the local...
Or pull their own teeth out. Don't they do that?
Because you can't get dentists. Shocking picture for me on page 19 of The Sun. This is High Street Shootout. Now, this is actually a case that was in court, I think, today, at the Old Bailey. A man was convicted of possession of a firearm. But you can clearly see a guy in a sort of, firing position up in Tottenham in North London, firing towards a VW Golf, which is circled in the picture, which you can see driving off. Apparently, the person in the VW Golf tried to shoot back. What? But the gun's stuck. I mean, it's like something seen out of, New York crime drama.
You never expected on the streets of London, would you? Not from the streets of London. And it is a shocking picture on that sort of basis. As you say, it's from a little while ago, but it's coming to court and that sort of stuff.
That's look, I have a friend who works in the... she's a detective in... I won't say where it is, but she said that... it's the knives and the... She said she's been to scenarios where they've got samurai swords and they cut through bodies like knives and like butter. Mm. And she said it's absolutely appalling. So, I mean, we are lucky that we don't have such a gun culture over here.
Yeah.
However, when someone does get a gun...
But the trouble is the gangs have all got guns.
That's the difference. And you can't bash them over the head with a truncheon when they're holding a Glock in your face.
I think that this story encapsulates the issue in London, the London bubble of the rise in violent crime as a whole and the inability of the Metropolitan Police to either stop and search or identify criminal gangs in time before things like this happen. We're seeing across the country violent crime increasing year on year on year, and the police, they've got, in the Metropolitan Police, they've got the funding, they've got the resources, and yet they're choosing to spend it on, on ridiculous vanity projects rather than keeping knives, guns, etc.
More diversity nonsense, I'm afraid, isn't it? We've got a little bit of breaking news just to finish up on the show. Live from New York City, they've apparently sworn in the entire jury.
Good heavens.
Wow.
I mean, incredibly, they've actually managed to find... I was told it was going to take 2 weeks.
Yes.
But they've found... I don't believe this, but they claim they've found people who don't have a view of Donald Trump.
I don't believe that at all.
I mean, I can't believe a word of that. But I guess we'll be bringing you more of that as it happens, of course, throughout the course of what could be one of the most exciting trials ever of a US president being charged with crimes. Incredible stuff. Anyway, that's all from me. Thank you to all of you, the two Sams and Andrew. You've been watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I'll be back, of course, with Plank of the Week tomorrow night at 7 p.m. It's only on Talk TV. See you then.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be.
Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.